Amazing. Good morning. For those who I've not yet met, my name is Johnny. I'm part of the team here, and it's great to be here this morning. So the last two Sundays, we've been journeying through kind of the Holy Week from Palm Sunday through to Easter Sunday. And this morning is just kind of a continuation of that, really. I want to share about Luke's account of Jesus appearing after the resurrection in a passage known as the Road to Emmaus. But before we get there, I wonder if you could just indulge me for a moment and come with me to Saturday, 23rd of May, 2015, at Wembley Stadium. And now, this date probably wasn't marked out in many of your calendars, but this day for myself and for my family was a huge day. Wycombe Wanderers, my hometown team, were playing at the National Stadium, the home of football itself. It doesn't happen very often. It had been 21 years since we played at Wembley. We'd never played at the new Wembley. And this was the moment where Wycombe were going to get promoted from the lowest division in Football League. We were on our way up. Anticipation was high. This was going to be a special day. Liz was there, my wife, my family, my parents, my friends. We all had lunch together, travelled up together, walked down Wembley Way. We knew that this was going to be a special day. And the game started off in quite a tense way. It was quite nervy, 0-0. Actually, 0-0 all the way through to 90 minutes. So the nerves were starting to set in, but we still had this hope, this belief that Wycombe were on our way up. It went to extra time. And in the beginning of extra time, Wycombe scored. And obviously, we erupted, hugging my family, hugging, kissing total strangers. Real moment of high. And this was it. It's happening, it's happening. We're going up. We're going to win at Wembley. It's going to be a day to tell our grandchildren. And then in the last moment, literally the last seconds, time had kind of run out. We were already singing songs about going up and all this. And the Wycombe midfielder gave the ball away on the halfway line. And the south end, the opponent player, started running down the line. And you know when time just kind of really starts to slow down and kind of sound all went down like really slowly. And as the winger ran down the line, he crossed it in. I think the ball actually did kind of pause in midair. Everyone was stopped. Everyone took in that deep breath. The ball bounced around a little bit, really scrambled, and the Southend player connected with it. It went through the legs of about three Wycombe defenders, past the keeper, into the bottom corner. Half the stadium in silence, in utter belief, as the other half of the stadium erupted in joy. Absolute sucker punch. The game went on to penalty shootouts, and Wycombe lost on penalties. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for sharing in my pain. We walked out of the stadium, hope diminished, heads down, broken people. Our hope, perhaps unsurprisingly, in Wycombe Wanderers was completely unfounded in that moment. And with that possibly exaggerated, definitely tenuous link, enter Luke chapter 24 and the road to Emmaus. Just as a little bit of context, this is the same day as the resurrection. Jesus has already appeared to Mary Magdalene, who's kind of gone to tell the disciples. They're plonkers, they don't believe her, they kind of run, try and check it out themselves. And there's two disciples walking away from Jerusalem on the way to Emmaus, it says. One of them is Cleopas, who'd been there at the crucifixion, and the other person, some scholars believe it may well be his wife, we're not fully sure, but these two people are walking away from Jerusalem, and I'm going to read the passage here for us. It'll be on the screen, or you can turn to it. Luke chapter 24 from verse 13. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. Amazing. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer all things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he was going to go further. When they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" And they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It is true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when they broke the bread. An amazing passage. And I want to just share a few thoughts on the theme of hope this morning, specifically around hope resigned, hope revealed, and hope returned as a framework so you know where we're going. For these two walking along, they'd seen Jesus ministering, they'd witnessed it, they'd heard his teaching, they'd start to dream with him, they'd seen it in his eyes, there was something special about this Jesus. And as Pete James explained to us a couple of weeks ago in the build-up to Palm Sunday, people were gathering in Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. You know, the place was absolutely buzzing. The place was alive. The atmosphere, the hope was palpable. There's this fresh kind of religious zeal that Jesus, the idea that Jesus is going to be the king that's going to bring this revolution. You know, they're starting to ask each other, when's it going to happen? How's it going to happen? Is it going to happen in the temple? Basically, they're getting... Disciples are getting ready to rumble. This is exciting. And then came the crucifixion. The most traumatic of deaths that they would have experienced watching it happen. You can imagine these two walking away, have that sense of just numbness. They're stunned, hopeless, dragging their feet, basically limping along the road to Emmaus. It says that it's 7 miles, so maybe a couple of hour walk, a long walk, in total lack of hope. And what's more, there'd been rumors of an empty tomb. There'd been rumors that Jesus wasn't there. They were so confused, what's going on? But for them, the crucifixion would have already spelt out perfectly clear, politically and theologically, that the exile was still incomplete, that the Romans were still in power, and that things had not happened how they thought it might. Verse 21, we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. We had hoped. We had hoped that the Messiah was going to come and conquer. And so often when things don't play out as we thought maybe they might, you know, we had hoped in a particular relationship to work out in a certain way. We had hoped in a job interview. We had hoped for particular exam results. We'd hoped for that health test, that scan. We'd hoped in the government. We'd hoped in the media, all these different ways. We'd hoped that our prayers might be answered in a particular way. But so often, as we know, life doesn't play out as we thought it might do. And as part of this morning, I really wanted to invite my friend Taylor to kind of come and share some of her story. Taylor usually goes to the 4:30, but can we give her a huge warm welcome for joining us? Not the other mic. Taylor, we've known each other for a little while. Taylor's from Southern California. She traded it all in for the weather of London via the weather of Watford. We worked together in Watford before, and then now we're at KXC. Taylor is one of the most amazing people I know, so hope-filled, so joyful, so alive in her faith. But Taylor, it's not always necessarily been that way. Do you want to share some of your story?
Yeah. Hi, guys. I grew up playing volleyball, and so I got recruited to play for my university in Seattle, Washington. So in a game against the Oregon Ducks, I actually fell and tore my ACL. And that wasn't that bad. If you're an athlete, you tear your ACL, within a year you can come back and play competitively again. So I knew that through surgery there was this hope of going back onto the court. Unfortunately, my surgery went wrong. So amidst the surgery, I basically created this condition called like deep compartment syndrome, where it basically suffocates there's too much pressure in my leg and it suffocated my blood flow to my foot. And so I was basically excused from the surgery, went to the hotel and something was wrong. Went to the ER, they thought it was just an allergic reaction. And so, because I had blood blisters all over my leg and it was swollen. But then, so they sent me home. And then I went back a couple days later. And the surgeon basically rushed me into the ER for an emergency surgery to cut open my leg and try to save my foot. And the surgery basically was this two-way flip of a coin. Like, either we can save your foot and restore blood flow, or we're going to have to amputate it. So I remember, like, going into the surgery. Sorry, it's just hard stuff. But going into the surgery, just thinking, like, I could come out without a foot and never play, never walk like I did before. And then thankfully the surgery went right, where I got blood flow back to my foot, but I had lost all like feeling and movement below the knee. So standing or walking was impossible. So I had to be on crutches for a long time, or like pushed in a wheelchair. And so I spiraled down into like complete depression, just feeling like the life I thought I would live was never going to be the same again. And so a lot of shame. I had massive scars from the surgery, and then also just this idea of I will never be able to walk again. And so, yeah, I basically got to this place of like the valley of the shadow of death, and felt like there was nothing that I could do on my own to get to a place of healing.
So you're in this, this valley, this pit, crying out to God. Kind of what happened from there?
Yeah, so I had to go back home to California and get some specialists. But I, because of nerve damage and not feeling, my nerves tried to regenerate by shocking me in my leg. So it felt like someone was tasering me like every 30 seconds. And so in this depression, I remember I was in my home alone, and I had just crawled up the stairs because I couldn't walk up them. And I remember like literally screaming at the top of my lungs in just utter anger and anguish, saying, God, if you're there, you need to answer me now. It was this moment where it felt like it was either going to be the end of my life or the beginning of a battle. And I just remember like just feeling compelled to open my Bible. And so I opened it. And thankfully, it wasn't like Leviticus or something like that. But it was sort of like that last call. And I opened up to Hosea 2, and it was 2:14. And it's basically Hosea is about God telling the prophet to marry a prostitute. And it's the promise of the Lord of Israel of like how he's going to redeem something that's so broken. And the verse that I read, like flipped it open, was... it was the proclamation that God was saying to her. And it was like, therefore I'm going to allure her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And the valley of Achor, which is like the valley of hell, will become a door of hope. And she will no longer, it goes on from 2:14, like she will no longer call me like God, but she will call me like Father. Then it goes into the covenant of God over her life. And I remember reading that, and it's like, again, sort of that verse, like my eyes just became clear of like there is a door and he's with me.
So this door of hope, literally, all plain sailing from there, or?
No, actually. So I was still in the pit health-wise, and it took 3 years of 5 surgeries. They had to take out one of my muscles. They had to put plates in my foot to help me actually walk normal. And But I knew that actually my life wasn't going to end. It was just the beginning because there was a door. I didn't exactly know what that door was. And so there was a couple of events that really like spurred this idea of hope and like hope revealed. And my mom would always, you know, go moms, would always say that when she saw my feet, she saw the feet of Jesus. And I never understood that. I thought something so ugly and scarred would never be something attributed to Christ. And so back up in Seattle, I had gotten up there, was still on crutches, walking at that point challengingly. I was in this art class, and I like art, but when you do like history of art, sometimes it can get a little dull. That's just my opinion. But the professor put on the photo of it's like the altarpiece of something, Grunewald. And it was the picture of the cross. And she focused in on his body. And it was the most realistic picture of the cross I'd ever seen. And she zoomed in particularly on his feet. And I saw the feet of Jesus. And they were marred and completely disgusting. And I started breaking down in class and was like, Jesus has my feet. Like, he has my feet on the cross. And at that point, I couldn't control myself. So I limped out of class. But I was overwhelmed by visually seeing Christ wear my scars on the crucifixion. A couple of weeks later, I had walked and I'd broken my foot just by walking. And I was sitting with one of my good friends and just crying and saying, no matter what I do, I can never win this battle. And I gave the analogy of, I feel like I'm the girl, reaching for the cloak of Jesus, but just never able to touch it. And then my friend just, looked at me, and she was like, Taylor, your battle has already been won by the cross, and you're not walking in the pain of the cross, but in the freedom of the resurrection. And it was the first time, again, I knew what salvation was. It was as if, someone had, turned on all the lights in me and was like, I'm walking in victory, even if that victory is with a limp.
Amazing. Should we just say thank you so much to Taylor for just thank you so much for sharing. Amazing story. Moving on back to the road to Emmaus. It's going to stay a little bit heavy for a while, but don't worry, we're kind of on the way up. The talk is about hope. These Emmaus-bound disciples don't recognize Jesus' presence originally. We read in verse 16. It's kept from them. Maybe they're just simply so full of grief that they don't see it. Sometimes disappointment can blind us from perceiving Jesus' presence around us, but they're kept from seeing. And Walter Brueggemann, who's an Old Testament scholar, he writes about this theory of kind of life moving into what he calls the pit, when kind of the world collapses around us, when nothing seems to make sense. And then he talks about a second move out of the pit and into a welcome place. And that's at that point we realize what has happened and who has brought us up out of the pit. He says this: the core narrative of human life is into the pit of trouble and out of the pit by the power of Yahweh. And in a similar way, here at KXC, we talk quite a lot about kind of the spiritual journey and the shape of discipleship, this idea that there's a descent, an emptying, and an ascent, or a filling, a kind of dying to ourselves, to the situations, to a pit, if you like, from Brueggemann, and then an ascent, life in its fullness from Jesus, and how that fits with, of course, the wider scripture, the wider narrative. Through this emptying, this descent, and this filling, this ascent, and it was amazing how Kath kind of summed it up earlier. I've been realizing this week afresh about the idea that discipleship with Jesus, there's a cost to it. There's a huge cost to it. It's not always easy. There's a call to kind of die to ourselves, to our longings, and often, so often, our hopes. And I used to work for a charity that support Christians facing persecution around the world. And it was this kind of daily lesson for me of learning from Christians that were willing to pay the cost. No matter what their day might face, sometimes their life was literally on the line, they were willing to daily say, Jesus, I'm going to follow you. I'm going to pick up my cross. I'm going to live for your glory. And there's just so many stories of kind of inspiration, but also challenge for me. But one particularly that I want to share this morning is of this lady from North Korea, one of the hardest places to be a Christian. Over 70 years old when I met her, barely 5 foot tall, but by far one of the most kind of powerful women of faith I've ever met. She's called Haewoo from North Korea. And she told her story, and her husband had become a Christian through a trip to China and had been kind of found and put in what's often the case for Christians in North Korea, this kind of labor camp, horrendous conditions. And he actually ended up dying in this camp. But before that, he'd kind of shared messages with his family and his kids through kind of secret ways, as you have to. And Haewoo had become a Christian as well. She'd found this hope. She also got to travel to China to kind of meet with these small house churches. And her faith was really starting to come alive when she got caught and she was placed in one of these awful camps. And just to kind of very, you know, I won't go into it too much, but just there would be just dead bodies along the path regularly. Mental torture, physical torture, hard days, labor, day in, day out. These were the kind of conditions through which she was trying to live out her faith. One time when I had lunch with her, the lunch that was served had some kind of sweet corn on it. And I just remember being amazed. Her face kind of really changed. And she asked if I could eat her sweet corn, because I think basically she'd only eaten corn for however many years in that camp. And it obviously brought back all of these things. Just, amazing moment, just really shocked me. But she would meditate. She'd learned just a few scriptures from her time in China. She would meditate all the time on Psalm 23, and she would really try and share her faith in these situations. She'd share her food, even though there was barely any. She'd try and kind of wash her fellow prisoners, and particularly for the women, you can imagine how hard it would be. She started these like little tiny secret church gatherings within these conditions. What they would do is they'd meet in the toilets, because that was basically the one place where the guards wouldn't go. You can imagine the kind of stench, just three or four gathering together, sharing quick prayers, singing in their heads. She would describe how they would sing in silent in their heads together as worship. And they would encourage each other, pray for one another, and then go off. Literally a message of hope to her fellow prisoners in the place of death. And I just remember being so inspired, so challenged by Haewoo. But it was a reminder again that we're all called at some level. It's going to look different for everyone, but there's a call to a cost. There's a call when we reach that pit, or through however way it happens, actually, to just give it all back to God, to say, Jesus, I cannot do this without you. I'm empty. I need to be filled, just as Taylor shared so bravely this morning. And even out of the pit, it doesn't mean that we're not going to face hardships. You know, even once we've met Jesus, been filled with the Spirit in an amazing way, there's still going to be unanswered questions, as there was for the two on the way to Emmaus. You know, I don't know why my friend has got cancer at 23, for example. I don't know why atrocities are happening around the world. The violence across London this week and even locally last night. Sometimes all we can do is mourn with those who are mourning. All we can do is pray, Jesus, have mercy. But I really, and we can't, I don't really have time to get into too much of the theology here, but we need a spirituality that doesn't deny the complexities of life. That said, you know, there's not always neat and tidy answers. We're not always going to answer things with a simple kind of theological soundbite. And I love this quote by a theologian, Jürgen Moltmann. He suggests that the only real theological friend in times of utter pain is the crucified Jesus. When we're going through hard times, through times of hopelessness, we look to Jesus who suffered, who died. We look to the Jesus who cried out himself, my God, why have you forsaken me? The Jesus in this passage who walks towards us as we're walking away from him. But also the Jesus that's triumphed over sin and death. The Easter story that we've just heard. I love the way that Tim put it last week. He described Jesus as doing an Airbnb with the grave rather than taking out a mortgage. I thought that was a helpful way to look at it. He's conquered sin and death. He's brought us back into relationship with God, brought us back filled with new life. and gives us purpose. And as Jesus meets with these two, he opens their eyes to his presence. He's the one that opens their eyes to him, as he does with all of us. You know, we can only love because he has first loved us. He gives us a new identity. He gives us a new purpose, a why to our lives. I've been interested for a while in this Austrian psychiatrist called Viktor Frankl, who writes a lot about kind of meaning and purpose, particularly in the midst of suffering. And Liz and I visited his home, which is now a museum, in Vienna a couple of years ago. He said this quote, which has stuck with me: "Those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how." And it's in relationship with Jesus that we find our why. And oh, how the society around us today needs a why, needs Jesus. Jesus who's with us. It's the story at Christmas, Emmanuel, God with us, and it's the story, as Matthew tells us, it will be the story till the very end of the age that he is with us. What's true in the light remains true in the dark times. And as Christians, our hope is anchored in the character of God, in the belief that God is good. Even if we can't see it, even if we can't experience it in those times in the hospital room, times in a labor camp, times in our confusion, what we're going through today, God is still good. And Christian hope is anchored in that truth. To return to the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, they invite Jesus for tea, basically. They say, "Come on in, please stay." They invite him in, only to discover that really it was Jesus who was inviting them into a new space, into the wide open space. God had been working in ways they'd never dreamed of, new and breathtaking possibilities that the scriptures had long been pointing to. I love the bit where Jesus basically explains the scriptures to them from verse 27, beginning with Moses and all the prophets. He exclaimed to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. So the scriptures at that time would have been the Torah, the law of Moses, the Nevi'im, which was the writings of the prophets, and the Ketuvim, which is known as like writing, sometimes includes the Psalms, as it talks about in verse 40 in this passage. And, well, firstly, if there's any podcast or any lecture that I'd want to go to, overview of the Old Testament with Jesus of Nazareth, that would be an unbelievable lesson in the scriptures. But I love, and their response makes so much sense. "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? Were not our hearts burning within us?" Could it really be the climax of these scriptures, how sins are to be forgiven, how the new kingdom, God's kingdom, is coming? Could it really be what our hearts not burning within us at this truth? An experience perhaps like many of us at times where Jesus has met us on our own journeys. This phrase actually really reminded me this week of John Wesley. And he was in a bit of a dire situation with his faith. He was just trying to do it all by himself, this idea of salvation through works. And he was just in a bad, bad way. And he went to this Moravian prayer meeting down now roughly where the Barbican is, about 300 years ago. And midway through this prayer meeting, he basically exclaimed, it's quite a famous phrase now, "I felt my heart strangely warmed." He experienced God in the midst of turmoil. "I felt my heart strangely warmed." And this was a kind of really similar experience for me in some ways, in a quite undramatic but beautiful way. In third year of university, I was back at home for the Christmas holidays in my room. And I was just kind of on my own, just reflecting really. And I was not in a good way. I'd had a quite painful relationship breakup just recently, doing a course that I didn't really enjoy, had gone to America for a semester just to try and get away from it for a bit, and still believed in God, was still kind of clinging on, but just realized that I was living this kind of selfish existence, lacking hope, lacking vision, lacking the reality of life with Jesus. And there was just this overwhelming sense of, if Jesus is Lord, if Jesus really is Lord, like I would maybe say he was, then it wouldn't mean something so different to the life that I was living. Either he's Lord of all of it. And it was just this sense, actually, I can relate to this, my heart being strangely warmed, meeting with Jesus, just there in my room on my own in the university holidays. And prayed there and then for a Christian friend. Basically, I hadn't really met that many Christians to journey with at uni, and just that was my kind of simple prayer. And 3 days later, this guy who I'd met through playing football for a team rang me, and randomly he was looking for somewhere to stay for a little while. So I said, yeah, come stay with us. And in the end, this friendship became a kind of real lifeline for me. We spent the rest of the term just like really journeying together, praying together, you know, and it was just an amazing gift from God. But just that sense that even if it's in an undramatic way, Jesus warming our hearts, not our hearts burning within us. The relationship, the realization that God is with us in relationship, longs to be in relationship, giving us himself, revealing himself. And it's that relationship from which everything has to flow. Everything comes from there, which gives us hope. In this passage, Jesus restores the disciples' vision. He gives them fresh hope. He reignites the dying embers of their dreams back into flames. And we read that they got up straight away and returned to Jerusalem. So straight away, they basically about turned back to Jerusalem to share the good news. They're back in the game. They've met with Jesus and they've got something to share. And this guy called Ron Rollheiser talks a bit about the significance and the symbolism of Jerusalem and Emmaus, the two places, two locations in this story. Jerusalem representing the faith dream, representing the hope, representing the adventure, and Emmaus representing human comfort, self-sufficiency, consolation. And in fact, Emmaus was to become a kind of Roman spa town, so it literally was a definition of kind of human comfort. And this is hugely challenging for us today. Pete Gregg gets at something really similar in his recent book, Dirty Glory. He talks about this place called Blue Camp 20. And apparently in the 1800s, kind of hundreds and thousands of people were making this kind of voyage, this journey down to Santa Fe. That it was a long and dangerous journey. They were basically searching for gold, for cattle, for kind of prosperity in a new life. And there was this camp, this Blue Camp 20, that was it was 20 miles from the beginning of the trail. So it's kind of known as this point at which if you go on from here, you're all in. It's going to be a tough journey. It's going to take a long time, but you're all in. And gradually over time, this small campsite became a settlement. This settlement became a town. And this town even got the name Little Santa Fe. It was like this smaller version of the adventure that they were already on, the adventure that they were aiming for. They had kind of given up, got comfortable, and settled in Little Santa Fe. Isn't that true so much for us in our faith journeys? And for these disciples, they don't settle for Emmaus. They don't settle for the comfort, consolation of that. Straight away, they turn back and head back to Jerusalem. So the road to Emmaus becomes the road to Jerusalem, the road to discipleship. The road of despair becomes the road of hope. I believe as followers of Jesus, we're future people living in the present, with recklessly give ourselves away, as we say here, you know, contagious carriers of hope, of love, witnessing to the kingdom, pointing to the kingdom. We're to carry this hope in a world so desperately in need around us, this area, the nation, the nations. I believe that hope can characterize us as the people of God. And there's a phrase you may well know, that we're blessed to be a blessing. It was a call that God gave Abraham, and it's a call that remains for the people of God through today. We're blessed. God has given us this hope so that we can carry it to others, so that we can be a blessing to others. And as an illustration of that, there's this salt lake in the Jordan Rift Valley, and water kind of channels into the lake, but there's nowhere for the water to go. And as a result, the lake is 9 times saltier than the ocean. And we know this place as the Dead Sea. And I think it's a remarkable challenge for us in our faith that if kind of blessings flow in, there's nowhere for them to bless out, nowhere for them to flow out. In effect, our faith is dead. You know, we're called to be a blessing to others, to return to Jerusalem, no matter the cost, to carry this hope to others, not to dwell in Emmaus, but to return to Jerusalem. So to finish, when hope is resigned, may we recognize Jesus' presence among us. As hope is revealed to us, would our hearts be burning within us? And would we be energized to go and share the good news as hope is returned? Knowing that ultimately our hope is located in Jesus Christ.